Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else, the Iditarod, and Brent Sass winning the race in a nail-biter to the end. I'm your host, Casey Grove. The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media, and I'm joined by my colleagues Lex Trinan, who's in Nome, and Tegan Hanlon here in the studio in Anchorage. Hello, you two.
Hey, Casey.
Hey, Casey.
Hello, and yes, that's right, the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race has a new champion. Because despite a howling windstorm that almost derailed him and his team in the last few miles of the 1,000-mile race, Brent Sass pulled into Nome with 11 dogs Tuesday morning, passing under the famed Burled Arch finish line just before 5:40 a.m. to win the 50th running of the Iditarod.
Ladies and gentlemen, here comes Brent Sass.
It's his first Iditarod championship, and the 42-year-old Sass and his Alaskan Huskies arrived to throngs of cheering race fans lining the finish chute on Front Street for the first time since before the coronavirus pandemic hit 2 years ago. Upon parking his team at the end of this epic journey, Sass immediately went dog to dog, petting each one and giving them snacks.
It's awesome. It's a dream come true. You know, when I started mushing, my goal was to win the Yukon Quest and win the Iditarod, and checked them both off the list now. So it's awesome. I mean, every one of these dogs I've raised since puppies, and we've been working towards this goal the whole time, and yeah, we're here. It's crazy.
His official time was 8 days, 14 hours, 38 minutes, and 43 seconds. I think that's the second fastest time on the normal northern route. And Sass had to earn every minute of that, holding off the hard-charging team of five-time champ Dallas Seavey, who was looking to become the winningest musher in Iditarod history. We're going to talk more about how that duel played out at the front between Sass and Seavey, how it had become Sass's race to lose, really. But first, about that wind. Because of that, Sass really could have lost it near the end. Tegan, you and many others were watching the Iditarod's GPS tracker. What did Brent Sass's struggle look like at the end of the race?
Yeah, so you know, it was last night in Anchorage. I was like setting my phone alarm for 3 a.m. to wake up and see where Brent Sass was on the route. But before doing that, I quick turned over to the tracker just to see how far from Nome he was. At that point, he had more than a 2 hour lead on Dallas Seavey. So I thought, maybe I can like kind of rough calculate, do I need to wake up at 3 a.m.? Could I make that alarm a little bit later? And Brent Sass, instead of his little tracker thing being green, it was orange, like 50 miles outside of Nome, which meant that he was just resting there. So I was like, oh, that's pretty weird that he's not moving. So, you know, I hopped over to Facebook on my phone, and there was a ton of chatter on Facebook. A lot of, does anyone know what's going on? People freaking out. Has he moved? It must be the wind. How long has he been there? And so Sass was stopped at this area that's kind of like famously gusty, and it can kind of turn a race upside down. And as you were like watching Brent Sass not moving, having no idea what's going on or when he might move, you could see Dallas Seavey's little green tracker continue to move down the trail closer and closer. I think I took a screenshot and like messaged it to you and Lex Trinan and Jeff Chen, who are in Nome, to be like, guys, look what's going on.
Yeah. It definitely was right down to the wire, it seemed like. I mean, we kept saying, you know, heading into today, heading into this finish, that Dallas Seavey's still back there. He could still come up. We've seen him come out of nowhere and win races before. So as you were seeing Brent Sass struggle there, it certainly seemed like anything was still possible right up to the end. Lex, I wanted to ask you, you know, being in Nome, what was that like? What was the mood like, and what did you see?
Yeah, I mean, the same thing, kind of that anticipation of, you know, we thought Brent Sass had it in the bag, but then when we saw him stopping, I think there was a little bit of that energy. I certainly felt it, just not knowing, even when we heard he was 3 miles out, just realizing how precarious any lead in the Iditarod is. Any sort of thing could really derail your your plans. But yeah, I went down to the finish shoot out on Front Street in Nome. As usual, you know, it was crowded. There's lots of people there, whatever time of night or day the race comes in. The Front Street, for those of you who haven't been to Nome, it's on the waterfront. There's a line of buildings, some restaurants and bars, things like that. And they set up a bunch of snow on the street and kind of cordon it off so spectators can't walk next to the mushers or get in the way of the dog teams coming in. There was a lot of people. As I said, I didn't get a really good estimate, but certainly hundreds of people. I saw among the faces, our former Governor Bill Walker was there. And everyone was just kind of waiting with bated breath, waiting for the headlamp of Brent Sass to appear at the end of Front Street as he was coming in, the east end of Front Street. So everyone was looking every time there was a, you know, a faint headlight, people would cheer. But, you know, it still wasn't clear until the very end that this was indeed Brent Sass. Sass talked after finishing about how difficult it was for his team to stay on the trail. The wind made it super hard. We saw reports of gusts up to 50, 60 miles per hour almost. And he's apparently had to stop out there. We haven't gotten a lot of details, but somewhere out there on the trail, Sass had to stop and just kind of regroup and get his team moving again. Here's what he said.
I don't even know what the wind was blowing out there. I mean, I couldn't see anything. The dogs, the only reason we got out of there is because they trusted me to get them back to the trail. And then once we got back to the trail, they just took off 100 miles an hour again, and we were able to stay on the trail and get into here. It was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun. A lot more stories now.
And it was just such an emotional scene to see him come to the finish line. He'd finally done it, finally got his Iditarod championship. He's been such a strong musher this year, and just to see this was really a really powerful moment. He hugged his dad. His dad was crying, you know, kind of saying, "We did it. We finally did it." He also got a really big hug from his longtime handler, Steve Stoller, a.k.a. Captain Stoller. He petted his dogs, gave him snacks, all those usual things that mushers do at pretty much each checkpoint. Then, of course, he got all these rewards and accolades, and sponsors wanted photos, and they wanted, you know, their handshakes and everything like that. He also got a novelty check presented to him there.
Sass also presented the Golden Harness Award to a couple of his dogs, which we'll get into here in a little bit. Real quick, Lex, have you ever covered a dog race that Brent Sass did not win?
I have not. I have covered four dog races that Brent Sass has competed in, and he has won four of them, including 2,000-mile races, 2,000-mile Yukon Quest races. So that's why they call me Lucky Lex.
Lucky Lex. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of our friend Zachariah Hughes, who... he covered the race, I think, 6 years in a row, and I'm pretty sure five of those, a CV of some kind, won those races. And just thinking about that scene at the finish and seeing a dog team, any dog team, mush up off the sea ice and onto Front Street, it brought back a lot of memories for me. I don't know about you, Tegan, but it's just such a familiar scene, and it's like there's a lot of emotion there that isn't even about the musher necessarily. It's like you've seen these guys going along for over a week now, 1,000 miles with their dogs, and then the dogs coming up, running to the finish line. It just, I don't know. It's just, it's like just a very familiar, I don't know, emotional moment. What do you think?
Yeah, totally. And it's kind of like, it's such a unique sporting event where it plays out over 1,000 miles of really remote Alaska. And so it's kind of like, you know, right, for 10 days or 8 days, you're following these mushers, you know, you're flying and hopping between checkpoints and catching them after these long runs. Because it's so long, you hear about the ups and the downs, or as Lex, you know, filled us in on, the mishaps. And so, yeah, it just feels like this big closing chapter, feels cliche, but this big punctuation point on this massive sporting event, adventure for some.
Festival in some ways. Yeah. And I don't know, I think just, for me, like, you see those dogs and it's just, I just feel so proud of them or something, you know, like they made it so far, but just to see them at the finish line, I don't know, it just kind of brings back a lot of memories. Anyway, of course, it's not the first time that Brent Sass has crossed the finish line in the Iditarod. This was his 7th attempt. He is a 3-time Yukon Quest 1,000-mile champ who mushes out of that remote homestead kennel north of Fairbanks in Eureka called Wild and Free Mushing. And for his first Iditarod win, Tegan, tell us what Brent Sass has won.
Excellent question, Casey. I honestly don't know for sure. That big check that Lex talked about, it said $50,000 on it. But we had emailed race officials last night just to see if they could give us a heads up on what the total race winning would be for the first musher in. And it got kind of technical. The Iditarod says SAS wins, as they referred to it, the highest percentage of a race purse of at least $500,000, which depends on how many other mushers finish the race. So everybody in the top 20, SAS included, is paid a certain percentage of that total purse, and then all the other finishers each receive $1,049. So I guess I'm not sure exactly how much SAS has won, but, you know, I do know that I asked them, did he win a truck, which mushers won for many years, or last year CV won a snow machine, and the Iditarod said, nope, no truck or snow machine this year. But outside of the finish, SAS did win a handful of other prizes from different checkpoints. That includes a total of $13,000 in cash and gold nuggets even. He also won 25 pounds of salmon, a gourmet 5-course meal in Ruby, which he gave to race volunteers so he could continue mushing down the trail. There was also some artwork and a bunch of other prizes along the way.
That's right. And just to be clear, he didn't have to carry all of that with him along the way. And SAS has won some of that stuff before, certainly the money from the Iditarod for finishing the race. His highest finish prior to this year was third. That was last year on an altered course from Willow to the ghost town of Iditarod and back. And that was when it was rerouted away from the usual village checkpoints due to concern over spreading coronavirus. And as it happens, the first time the race did not finish in Nome. We're going to talk more about SAS as a person and as an Iditarod musher, but just to note it now, he started running the also 1,000-mile Yukon Quest in 2007 and then raced his first Iditarod in 2012, placing 13th. That was the best of any Iditarod newbie that year, so that won him the Rookie of the Year award. But SAS has faced problems that came in later Iditarods. Tegan, you and I witnessed some of that, and we're going to get into it in a couple minutes. Tegan pointed out to me earlier that that 2012 race, Brent's first, was also Dallas's first win. He was 25 at the time, and that made him the youngest to win, still the youngest to ever win the Iditarod. In this year's race, SAS had led CV since right around race mile 400 outside of the Ophir checkpoint, so for more than half of the race. And even without the windstorm and the heart attacks sort of induced by SAS stopping along the way there at the end, there were times earlier in the race when it seemed like CV was really just still too close for comfort. In the finish shoot, SAS was asked about what it meant to have beat CV.
Yeah, I mean, that, to be honest, that just makes it sweeter. You know, he's the best right now, you know, and being able to sort of keep him at bay the whole entire race and race against the best guy in the business, that just makes this victory even sweeter.
As for Dallas CV's arrival in Nome, Lex, what happened there?
Yeah, so it was just a little over an hour later after SAS had finished and we went back down to Front Street. There were crowds there, not quite as big, but certainly enough to cheer him on and cheer his seven dogs in. He only had seven dogs in harness, the result, he said, of a gastrointestinal sickness that hit his dogs early on. And throughout the race, he just had to drop a few dogs along the way. He didn't really say much. He didn't answer any reporter's question. One reporter got a question in and he kind of just focused on his dogs, really, which is something that you do see him do at a lot of checkpoints. He usually asks for time with his dogs to do his dog care thing before he finishes. But it was a little bit notable, too, that he didn't really say much even about the trail conditions. He kind of mentioned that sickness that had gone through his dogs. But it was also emotional for him. You know, his 12-year-old daughter was there. She got some big hugs, a couple other folks, friends and handlers. He got big hugs from them. He also asked at one point for a photo with his two leaders, Prophet and North. He mentioned to the person taking the photo that this might be the last time or the only time that he'll get to take a photo with them under the Burled Arch of Nome. So, you know, it had this kind of bittersweet quality to it because he said that he's stepping away from the race, at least for a few years, to focus on his 12-year-old. But he also hinted that he will be back in the race. I asked him in White Mountain whether he thought if he does finish in second place, if that's going to motivate him to get back to the race sooner. And he said no. He's really committed to his daughter and making sure he can be the best dad he can be for her. but he certainly sounded like he wants to get back to the Iditarod someday. Anyway, he was only about an hour and 10 minutes behind Sass, though. That's after Sass had a 2-hour, 37-minute lead out of White Mountain, where mushers had to take a mandatory 8-hour rest before the final 77 miles to the finish. Stevie had cut that gap between his team and Sass's by more than half, but both mushers were still way ahead of the pack. We're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, and none of the mushers are even through to a safety, the checkpoint that's 22 miles from the finish.
That's right, Sass and Stevie were way ahead of everybody else, in third and fourth place respectively, and still on the way from White Mountain to safety, and then hopefully on to Nome. As we speak, are Jesse Holmes and Dan Caduce. They actually left White Mountain just 13 minutes apart, which is fun, but it was just about 6 hours after Sass had already crossed the finish line, and of course they still had that final almost 80 miles to go, and they had been something like 14 hours behind Seavey into White Mountain. One thing that we noted in a story that Lex put together yesterday was that Dan Caduce is still mushing with all 14 dogs, and his runtime into White Mountain was actually faster than any other musher at that point. Caduce still has all 14 dogs that he started with, and that's compared to Jesse Holmes' 9. Holmes still leading by just a little bit, according to the Iditarod.com GPS tracker, but he's picked up a bunch of positions. I think we noted that yesterday, and he had already picked up a bunch of positions to get into 7th place and is now in 4th and maybe poised to pull into 3rd place even. So we'll see how that plays out. Holmes and Caduce are followed by Richie Deal, Pete Kaiser, Aaron Burmeister, Chad Stoddard. Very impressive to see Chad Stoddard so far up in the top 10 in his second Iditarod. Then you have Ryan Reddington and Travis Beals just to round out the top 10. And with Sass and Seavey now finished, that means there's a total of 44 mushers still racing toward Nome. Since we're still talking about that battle for first, though, Lex, you put together a story for us sort of setting the table for Sass's first win.
Right. And like I said earlier, Sass had led for more than half of the race. And I definitely say the table was set when the two arrived in White Mountain on Monday. I flew in there yesterday afternoon to catch both of them pull into the checkpoint, which was kind of set out outside of town. The community didn't really want folks coming into the community because of COVID concerns. To get to the lead, Sass had made a move hundreds of miles earlier. Nasivi was going to steal the lead. He was going to need Sass's team to falter or the musher to make some sort of major mistake. I guess I would say like this. We didn't know yet about what was going to happen with the wind, but it still didn't seem like the cushion Sass had of about 2.5 hours was enough to let him relax.
That's right, and it sort of turned out that it was not enough to relax. Anyway, without further ado, Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports.
Francis was tired, but still helping his 12-dog team push the sled as they pulled into White Mountain on Monday. He said his heels were bloody from scooting the sled over hundreds of miles.
Ready for a nap?
Oh yeah, them and me.
The village's church bells rang out to announce his arrival, but only a few locals were there to greet him. The community opted to stay separated from the checkpoint this year because of COVID concerns. Sass was in a state of exhaustion, but also disbelief.
Oh, well. Oh boy. Well, we made it.
How you feeling?
I'm in shock, maybe? I don't really know yet.
Sass has been dreaming of an Iditarod win for years. He's been leading toward the end of the race before, but never this far, and never with a dog team he's so confident in. It took him a lot to get here, including a brutal run over Sunday night and Monday, during which his sled runner broke.
I pretty much thought I was giving up my lead the whole way. The mental game set in last night big time.
He imagined Dallas Seavey coming up behind him. He was at the verge of nodding off on the back of his sled, but a bout of wind snapped him out of it and perked up his team.
Then they rallied. They had a big rally last night for the second half of our run, which brought my attitude around and I forgot about all the sled issues.
And Seavey was right there behind him. Even a gap of 18 miles at times wouldn't have been enough for Sass to feel comfortable. Like Sass, Seavey has ski pulled in, though he preferred to sit on his sled out of the wind instead of standing. But Seavey wasn't confident he had a chance to win the race.
I mean, unless something goes wrong, I don't think so. I mean, honestly, ever since Griffel, the race was kind of over for it.
Stevie said he's been building his team back up since they'd been sick earlier in the race. They'd finally started eating better in the second half.
And it's made it pretty easy for Brent to just not make any major mistakes and stay the same distance ahead, which is exactly what he's done. He's run a perfect race as far as from Cripple to here.
It was Sass's move to blow through Ruby into the Yukon River and through Galena to take a mandatory 8-hour rest in Caltag, plus the decision to mush out onto the Sias beyond Shaktulik, where he bundled his team in a pile under a blanket to rest that kept him ahead of Seavey. But even with the healthy lead into White Mountain, the pressure was still on, and Sass and everyone watching the race knew they couldn't count Seavey out. Reporting on the Iditarod Trail, I'm Lex Trinan.
Thanks for that, Lex. Okay, so clearly Brent Sass never stopped looking over his shoulder, and having Dallas Seavey chasing you has to be motivating, to say the least, even when the wind made him feel like stopping. But what kind of determination does that take? I mean, really, what kind of person has that determination to push through all of that? We know it meant raising all of those dogs, training them up, hundreds and hundreds of miles of running, but how did Brent Sass get here? Lex, you asked him in White Mountain about what he represents.
Yeah, I sort of asked him, you know, both himself and Dallas Seavey are known as very intense competitors. So I was kind of curious, you know, what he thought he did differently or represented differently from Dallas Seavey. And he mentioned doing things like the old school mushers did. He called them the old school mushers. He's originally from Minnesota, but he's been in Alaska for a couple dozen years, and he's put more than two decades of his life into mushing at this point. And he's really just embraced the lifestyle of living out in the woods and, of course, mushing dogs. It's a lifestyle that allowed him to live out a dream that started when he was a college student in Fairbanks. He moved there to the Golden Heart City of Alaska, as it's known. It's right in the middle of the state. He moved there in 1998 to be a Nordic skier at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. One of his neighbors in the Goldstream Valley was a dog musher, and it didn't take long for Sass to get into it himself.
It's interesting to me to like think about how Sass got into dog mushing, that he just kind of, you know, it seems like fell into it in Fairbanks, just because that contrasts so heavily with what we know about Dallas Seavey, right? Like Dallas Seavey kind of has mushing, racing dogs in his blood. His dad, Mitch Seavey, races the Iditarod and is out on the trail right now. And then Mitch's dad, Dallas's grandfather, Dan, helped stage the very first Iditarod in 1973. So dog mushing is just something that Dallas has been around for a really, really long time. And in contrast, you know, it doesn't sound like Brent Sass had that mushing family growing up.
Yeah, and unlike Dallas, he's not competing against his dad out there on the trail. Anyway, even getting into it as an adult, Sass didn't just become a casual dog musher. He started a kennel and moved out to a remote homestead in Eureka. That's even farther north than Fairbanks. He says it's about a four-hour drive to get there on the Elliott Highway, if you're familiar with that. It's north of Fairbanks, kind of cuts west off of the main Dalton Highway Hall Road, as we call it. Then it's another 7 miles on a snow machine. So if Goldstream Valley is kind of Fairbanks' backyard north of the city, then Eureka is really the backyard to the backyard. It's the same area that Iditarod champions Susan Butcher and Rick Swenson used to train in. I visited Sass at a temporary 12 by 12 foot cabin. It was basically a shack before the start of this year's Yukon Quest in February. He'd kind of camped out there to just be closer to racing. He described for me there his lifestyle a bit, and he said, especially with the heavy snows this year, he's just been working 20 hours a day, sleeping for 4 hours, and then just doing it again. Sounds like just nonstop shoveling, chopping wood, and then, of course, dog mushing. Some days he told me he'd set a 20-mile trail on a snow machine through deep, heavy powder, then run the dogs for 4 or 5 hours, get their training miles in. By the time he was back at the house, it had snowed enough for him to have to go do it again. Even with all that, his team put in more than 4,000 miles of training this year, including three 300-mile races. He won all three, by the way. But those 4,000 miles, that's a lot even for these top competitive teams. And of course, now he's added another 1,000 miles to that log. Here's what he told me at the White Mountain checkpoint when I asked him what he represented.
Living where I live and doing the things that I do is why I do this. I would never be able to like live in town and just kind of train to race dogs. I think living out where I live and making it an all-inclusive lifestyle, I think that's, you know, the way it used to be is kind of the way it is, you know, for me. So maybe that's what I represent, sort of the old school in all of this, because
I'm still living, you know, like Susan and Rick did back in the day. So,
and just to be clear, when he mentions Susan and Rick there, he's talking about four-time Iditarod champion Susan Butcher, the last woman to win the Iditarod. And then Rick is Rick Swenson, the five-time champion who is tied with Dallas Seavey for the most wins in Iditarod history. And Sass actually trained with Susan Butcher some in his early years. And then Butcher passed away from cancer in 2006, right around when Sass really started to get into competitive mushing. So that's the spirit it seems like Sass is carrying with him along the way in all these races, everywhere he mushes. As we've said before, he's a longtime Yukon Quest musher, first running the 300-mile version of that race in 2006, that being a qualifier for both the 1,000-mile Yukon Quest and the Iditarod. And then he ran the 1,000-mile Yukon Quest for the first time in 2007, first won it in 2015. And then somewhere back in there, Sass went to mush the Iditarod for the first time in 2012. That's when he won Rookie of the Year. And that gets us to the Iditarod. But Tegan, it wasn't exactly smooth sailing from there straight to a championship, was it?
No, I wouldn't call it smooth sailing. You know, there's like, I think as we've talked about before, it's this 1,000-mile race. There's so many things that can go wrong and do go wrong for every team. But it feels like, thinking about Sass's history with the Iditarod, he had two pretty big things go wrong. Maybe let's start in 2015. So during that year's Iditarod, Sass is like 250 miles almost into the race. He's in fifth place. And then he gets disqualified. Race officials boot him from the Iditarod. And it was because he had an iPod Touch. And that violated a rule against mushers carrying devices capable of two-way communication. So most people think of, you know, cell phones, in-reach satellite devices. But because the iPod Touch could connect up to Wi-Fi, race officials said Sass had to leave the race. He had violated the rule. It was super divisive at the time. I remember some people saying, like, this is bonkers. He was, you know, using the iPod Touch for music. Where is he going to get on the Wi-Fi? He's not trying to cheat. And then there were other people who were like, the rules are the rules. And he had an iPod Touch. The idea of the rule was that if mushers could get in contact with people, they could, you know, get some intel about the weather or other sort of coaching help. That rule has since actually been rescinded and mushers can now carry cell phones and other two-way communication devices. But, well, that wasn't the case in 2015, unfortunately, for Brent Sass. That year, the race was rerouted through some interior Alaska villages, including Tanana, which is where Sass did find out that he could no longer be in the Iditarod. Here's Sass describing what happened, and you can hear in this clip, he just sounds really disappointed. This is from 2015.
Well, I got disqualified from the Iditarod because I have a iPod Touch that I bring along for my music and movies that I was just stupid. I mean, I didn't use it, and I had zero intent in using it for a Wi-Fi connection in the checkpoints, but I was just completely clueless. I mean, I gave my dad my cell phone because I knew that you couldn't have cell phones on this race specifically, and I was just ignorant.
Casey, you were covering the race, right? Were you there in Tanana?
Yeah, I was there in Tanana, and I was covering the race for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, so the local paper, and Sass had just won the Yukon Quest, so he was definitely one of the favorite local guys for the Fairbanks newspaper competing in the Iditarod that year. My main memory is, yeah, how bummed out Brent was. I walked with him down to a hardware store before he got a couple of things and, you know, mushed his dogs away. And that's actually the other thing I really remember about that is that instead of getting home some other way, he was actually close enough to home that he just turned the dog team around and mushed them home. And he had a really good looking team. I mean, they had just come off of a Yukon Quest win. They had these matching race jackets on, and I was in the home of a 90-year-old woman who was the daughter of actually one of the original Serum Run mushers doing an interview with her when I just looked out the window, and there's Brent Sass and his dog team heading the wrong way on the trail trying to just get themselves home. And Brent told me that he actually, you know, cried a lot on the way, which I think is probably understandable with such a great team and such a competitive attitude going into that race. So that was 2015, but Tegan, Brent Sass had a really rough time again in the Iditarod for totally different reasons. That was 2016, and you were out on the trail covering that race, right?
Yeah. And that year, you know, Brent Sass, I remember him talking about that he was trying to keep up with the CVs. So he was running at the front of the pack with Dallas CV and with his dad, Mitch CV. And once they got to White Mountain, that checkpoint 77 miles from the finish, Sass was in third, pretty firmly behind Dallas and Mitch. But when it was his time to leave after that 8-hour rest, his dogs just wouldn't go. They refused to go down the trail. They just kind of sat there in protest for hours. And Sass slipped from third place to 20th place. I didn't see Sass try to leave White Mountain. We were already in Nome to cover the finish. But I remember being in Nome and going to the finish line when Sass was coming in 20th place. And he was super emotional, crying and saying he had pushed his dogs a little bit too hard and bent their trust while he was trying to, quote, I remember him saying, chase some CVs. He said at the time that his dog team not leaving White Mountain was the most embarrassing moment of his life. I think gut-wrenching was the word. I remember him kind of reiterating that he was really proud of his dogs and just really disappointed in himself.
Yeah, and that came up a few times this year when I talked to Sass along the trail. He has a few different motivational tattoos to remind him of different things, and he'll bust them out every once in a while, I guess when the weather's not too cold. He got one after that 2016 race. It says, run your own race. Also, I should note, though, despite him saying that at White Mountain, he certainly was competitive and asking about Dallas CV. So he kind of had to balance those two impulses, the competitiveness towards the end of the race, where mushers often do start to push their teams a little bit harder, and just the thought of keeping his race plan intact. And that's something that he did certainly very successfully on this course.
Yeah, I remember in those interviews that you got how much he kept talking about not wanting to make that same mistake again, and knowing what his dog team was capable of and making the right moves at the right time. And I guess maybe just to kind of sum up, I think, what the differences between Brent Sass and Dallas CV are, because there are many. They have very different personalities. They're both pretty candid when you talk to them. They'll tell you the truth. They'll tell you how they're feeling. Brent is a little bit more outgoing about it, maybe, or, you know, gregarious was a word I used to use. I think he's gotten a lot more focused in the last few years, and I don't know if that word really fits anymore. They're both focused, but Dallas is maybe, you know, a little bit more buttoned down and less emotional and just kind of gives you the facts and just lays it out there, whether those facts are in favor of him or someone else. He just tells you how it is. So, Lex, you were talking about Brent's tattoos. Are you going to get any tattoos to remind you of what it was like to cover this year's race?
Yeah, I better get one that says Lucky Lex. I'll put it right on my bicep here. I'll have to work out, though, to get biceps as big as Brent Sass's, though.
I was thinking you should get one that says you can't knock the hustle.
That's a good one, too. Maybe I'll get both.
Yeah, I like it. More tattoos for Lex. And, you know, if you get it on your bicep, whatever it is, that helps us call you not just Lucky Lex Trinan, but Flex Trinan. That's another one that we use. Okay, Lex, we need you to go get some sleep because we're going to be talking to you some more coming up in a future episode. Thanks to you and your fellow trail reporter, Jeff Chen, for all the hard work.
Absolutely. Aye, aye, Captain. Talk to you later. Captain Casey.
Captain Casey, I like the sound of that. We got Captain Tegan, Captain Casey, so many captains. Well, maybe you've noticed by now we're talking all about Brent Sass today on the pod, him being the 50th champion of the Iditarod. So naturally, today's listener question is about him, his dog team, and the dog of the day is from his team in no particular order. I guess here's the question of the day.
Hello, Iditapod and Casey. This is Zachariah Hughes, former Iditapodster, and I'm recording this listener question from inside of a bathroom to not wake the new sleeping baby that lives in our house. A question I had is, I've heard Brent Sass and some of the audio I've heard of this year's race call out to a leader named Slater, and I was wondering what this litter name is all about. A lot of the time mushers will name dogs, or they'll get litters of dogs that are have a litter of a theme to the litter names. So like, for example, a friend of mine this is all in an old podcast, but had a litter named after cuts of meat, like ribeye and flank and sirloin. So I'm wondering if you could send one of your intrepid trail reporters to whatever windswept creek bed Brent is camping at along the trail and go up and ask him, hey, Brent, what's the deal with Slater? What are his litter mates? What's the litter theme there? My suspicion, or my hope, I should say, it's a hope, is it's a Saved by the Bell litter theme. But that's just speculation on my part, and being housebound and on parental leave right now, I'm not able to get to that creek bed where I'm sure Brent is gingerly warming himself up some sort of gruel or tea during the 15 minutes between dog chores and embarking on the trail. Anyhow, I hope you're well, Casey. Godspeed.
Hey, I know that guy.
Zach.
It's Zach, our pal Zachariah Hughes. As he said, he found a baby somewhere, or I guess he and his wife Penny had a baby is what it was. Loretta Latzine Gage Hughes, not quite 3 months old yet. Welcome to the Ididapod, Loretta, and welcome to the world, by the way. Welcome back, Zach. Thanks for that question. Good to hear from you. Lex has your answer straight from the sass's mouth.
Slater and Morello, these two led a good portion of the race. They're amazing.
Assuming you make it numb with the golden harness.
Oh, these two, for sure, hands down. But Woody has led a lot, and then Katuk and Arlo did some leading on that on the ice yesterday when it was just really slow, and I didn't want to use these guys up at all. They just kind of trudged along at that 5 miles an hour pace, and so I let these guys take a break during that, which was really helpful for them. I knew I needed them for the second half of that run yesterday. I mean, he's almost been up there the whole race. It's hard to take him out because he just keeps the speed up more than anything. And same thing with her. And they're really good at just going through checkpoints without any hesitation or anything. So. Oh yeah. Every dog in the team I picked the breedings and raised every single one of them.
How old are they?
They're six. And yeah, him and Woody and then the other pink one, whose name is Pink, he's not pink, he's orange, but they're all litter mates. And
what's the litter theme name?
Oh, dazed and confused characters. They were born on 420. So they got characters from the Dazed and Confused movie.
And obviously we're going with Slater and Morello as the Ididapod Champions Edition Dogs of the Day, because that is who SAS awarded the Golden Harness Award to at the finish. Tegan, what even is that?
I actually looked it up because I didn't really know the history of the Golden Harness Award. So Lolly Medley was a Wasilla harness maker and one of only two women to run the second Iditarod in 1974. And so she started presenting a golden harness to an outstanding lead dog that the mushers got to choose. That started in 1977. And so the award continues today, and the top musher gets to pick their top one or two dogs to get the Golden Harness Award.
And at the finish line anyway, when they present that award, it's just this garland of yellow roses that they put on the dogs. And I've never seen a dog that won the Golden Harness Award that didn't look extremely satisfied with itself sitting there with that thing on it.
Yeah, they kind of have this big photo shoot with the dogs with their roses around their neck. The musher will have his or her arms around the dog. So it is definitely, it does seem like they look very satisfied.
Yeah, celebrity dogs.
Yeah.
What else can we say about these particular celebrity dogs, Slater and Morello?
Well, Sass has summed up the two dogs in one word, amazing. He says the dogs are great leaders and that they can blow through checkpoints without any hesitation, which is, a good thing for Sass because he doesn't usually stop at the checkpoints at the communities along the trail. He opts to rest off the trail further out instead in kind of the quiet and solitude. What we know about Slater is that he has two siblings on the team, Woody and Pink, and they are all part of the litter named after characters from the Dazed and Confused film. Sass told Lex that that's because they were born on 420. Slater is a good listener, eager to please, and is, quote, one of the most loving and happy dogs in the kennel.
And Slater's, we have pictures of this, but Slater is pretty whitish. It's kind of like, actually, apropos for a golden harness winner, sort of a golden tinge on the back there in the photos that I'm looking at.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the photos we have, too, it's like Slater's kind of relaxed on the snow. He has like a little black jacket on. It looks like kind of like a photo for Vogue, if there was a dog version for Vogue.
And just to kind of fill out that description on Brent Sass's wildandfreealaska.com, that's his website for his kennel, he says that Slater is one of the most loving and happy dogs in the kennel. He listens very well, is eager to please. And then
we also have Morello.
Tell me about Morello.
Morello is part of a litter named after not characters in a movie, but a TV series, Orange is the New Black. Also, according to Morello's online bio, she is a force to be reckoned with, has a strong personality, and has become one of Sass's main leaders. It sounds like her parents were also some of Sass's main leaders. And Morello has raced a bunch of other races, including the Yukon Quest, the Iditarod last year when Sass placed third, and the Copper Basin 300.
So, Zach, sorry, no, the dog Slater is not named after the character from Saved by the Bell, but, you know, good guess. In any case, they're clearly some good dogs. Sass mentioned a few in that clip earlier, but, you know, they make you pick only two for the Golden Harness Award. So there you go. We have pictures of Slater and Morello, plus photos from all over the Iditarod Trail, a bunch of good ones from Jeff Chen, Lex Trinan. There's a ton of written things online there, a whole bunch more at alaskapublic.org. And if you like the content that you hear from Alaska Public Media, I'm just going to throw out a plug. Maybe consider becoming a member of Alaska Public Media.
That would be fun.
Indeed. And as always, we'll continue to update you on the race there at alaskapublic.org. We're really looking forward to seeing what happens with Dan Caduce, Jesse Holmes, and the rest of the gang still mushing for Nome. We'll be back for another episode of the Iditapod, probably just one more for the season, I figure. And depending on what we find out tomorrow and when, it's unclear when that'll drop, but that'll be out sometime tomorrow, I suppose. That's Wednesday. The race may be over for Brent Sass and Dallas CV this year, but we have just a little bit more to go before we're done. Uh-oh, Tegan, I think I can hear that theme music playing again, so you know what that means. That is by the band Sassafras. Thanks to our little Iditapod team, Tegan Hanlon, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Lex Trinan and Jeff Chen still out on the trail. We're hoping to see them again here in Anchorage soon, safe and sound. As for the rest of you, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
Hey, Brent, you do realize that every race, the four races that I've covered where you've raced, you've won?
Well, you're my good luck charm, I guess, huh? That's funny.
Must give you a lot of pressure, huh?
Yeah, right.